Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
The courts and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Samsung and that phone, and Alan Greenspan and the whole doggone American economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of KQED in San Francisco, today I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 11th of October. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Unconstitutional is a very strong word. It implies a fundamental defect in a law or a regulation, or in this case, a government agency. This morning, a federal appeals court ruled the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is unconstitutional because its director isn't sufficiently answerable to the President of the United States. The court did say the agency can continue operating, but is requiring changes that will allow the president to remove the director at will. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has this latest installment in the long political fight over the consumer finance watchdog.
Washington legal star Ted Olson represented PHH. That's the mortgage company opposite the bureau in the case. His job here was to win, which he did, but he'd also like to see this ruling get lawmakers to fully rethink how they made the CFPB in the first place.
I would hope that members of Congress that created this agency would go back to the drawing board and take a look at the arguments we presented about separation of powers that are firmly embedded in the Constitution and do it over and do it right.
That's one viewpoint in what's been a big fight over the five-year-old consumer agency, stoking the passions of right and left, the financial industry, and its watchdogs. Isaac Boltansky tracks policy developments for Compass Point Research and Trading.
The CFPB has become one of the central battlegrounds in the ongoing war over the regulatory state in the country.
Supporters like University of Texas law professor Angela Litwin worry that letting presidents fire the bureau's directors at will threatens independence.
If there's a different president, they could remove a director for just disagreeing with the political vision and put in place somebody who did not have a strong consumer protection vision.
Today's court ruling gives all sides of this regulatory debate something to holler about, but Boltansky, the policy analyst, isn't sure foes of CFPB, including those who don't even want it to exist, will be able to get their way anytime soon.
The Wells Fargo scandal and the public outrage about it has effectively put a legislative moat around the bureau.
But both sides will keep fighting it out. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
After a first round of overheating and burning phones and then a second round of replacements for those overheating and burning phones that started overheating and burning themselves, Samsung has decided enough is enough with its one-time flagship Galaxy Note 7 smartphone. Production has been stopped, and now what happens? For that, we've got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, right here in the studio with me in San Francisco. Hey, Molly.
Hello, Kai.
I know, like face-to-face. It's amazing, right?
You're right there.
I'm here. You're there. This thing with the Samsung Note 7, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's really bad.
So, first of all, how bad is it? Is it like company crisis bad?
I mean, Samsung's smartphone line pretty much pays for a lot of the other stuff that they do, the R&D, the other lines, the other electronics. And they've already lost, as we know, about $17 billion in value. That is not including the future revenue, which could top $10 billion. And then, of course, there's the worst case scenario, which is that this ends up tainting not just the Samsung name, but the Galaxy line. There are other Galaxy phones. They're ramping up production of the Galaxy S7, not the Note.
Yep.
People aren't going to know the difference.
I was at a thing this morning and somebody looked at my colleague's phone and said, wait a minute, is that one of those that burns up? And she's like, no, it's not. It's one of the fine ones. And I'm like, you know what? If that's the conversation we're having, it's almost too late. There are, however, companies rubbing their hands together with glee at this, maybe not glee, but some satisfaction at this news. Apple, of course, but also Google, right, who picked the moment to get into this space with the Pixel.
It is remarkable timing on Google's part. I mean, I also have to say I think Apple dodged a bit of a bullet because they put out a phone that people weren't that excited about because of the headphone jack.
Right.
People were feeling like the iPhone 7 was maybe not as thrilling as it could have been. So they're in a good position now because they're the default.
Yep.
Alternative purchase. And then, of course, Google just got into the market with a premium smartphone that competed directly with that Galaxy line. The Pixel's coming out just in time to fill the void for Android shoppers who really want a nice high-end phone and don't know where else to turn.
Mm-hmm. What does Samsung do from here? Do they get back? Can they get back?
You know, this feels like one of those things that could potentially be fatal to at least the smartphone line. I would be surprised if they can revive the Galaxy lines of phones. I think that they regroup, they shut everything down, not just production of this one phone, and they have to come back with a strong rebrand and some sort of really, really powerful marketing campaign because this is a good, tough hill to climb.
There is also this issue of all those zillions of phones out there. They have customers. Is it on Samsung now to fix that, or is it on AT&T and T-Mobile and the carriers?
I mean, I think it's on Samsung, and I think that's the crucial first step to rebuilding that trust. Samsung has to come out and say to both its carrier partners and its customers, we are on it. We will come to your house and get this phone. We will do whatever it takes to get this out of your hands and keep you safe.
Except that the replacement phone didn't work out so well.
Oh, yeah. It's not even about replacements anymore.
Yeah. Right? Oh, no,
it's,
no, no.
It's
yeah,
give
no,
them totally. A credit. I mean, they need to go take all the steps that Volkswagen took, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe pay people.
Except better.
Maybe pay people to bring those phones back. I mean, they have got to get them back in-house, out of people's hands. Otherwise, this just lingers on. A month later, you got another phone exploding, and it's just a slow-motion disaster.
Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent right here with me in the studios at KQED. Thanks, Molly.
I'm right here. It's my pleasure.
Wall Street today, it's going to be the wah-wahs if I have anything to say about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. CNN published an editorial today by a guest writer titled, America Will Take the Giant Leap to Mars. The byline reads Barack Obama, and in his piece, the president says there are now more than 1,000 companies in the United States involved in the business of space. And he points out that getting people to Mars could turn out to be the ultimate public-private partnership. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more on the next frontier for the next frontier.
Just to be clear, there's a reason the government is not planning to send humans to Mars on its own, but know that it could if it wanted to.
Yes, assuming there's enough money.
Marco Caceres is a space analyst with the Thiel Group. He says when it comes to Mars, budget is where things can get a little awkward.
Well, see, this is the problem, is that whenever you talk about a program as ambitious as this, you don't want to talk money, because particularly if you're the government, because it will scare people away, it'll scare the public, it'll scare Congress.
Well, you're talking about billions and billions of dollars.
John Logsdon is professor emeritus at George Washington University Space Policy Institute. Companies used to just be contractors, but now there's a whole new private market competing to do business in space. And Logsdon says it's not just private companies like SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, and Sierra Nevada that are critical. We need more.
I think it's not only private-public partnership, but an international partnership that is actually essential.
Dan Dumbacher teaches engineering at Purdue University School of Aeronautics and Astronautics. He also used to work for NASA. He helped run the programs that built the Orion missions to Mars.
You have to have the government and private industry working together.
Dumbacher says, don't forget, NASA has been working with private vendors for years. But whoever is building the equipment for the next mission, Marco Cassera says getting to Mars is going to cost trillions. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Eight years ago this month, Alan Greenspan made what must have been for him a long, long trudge up Capitol Hill. The then and now former chairman of the Federal Reserve had been asked for his testimony as to the cause of the financial crisis, how a man whose economic sense was so good that he came to be called the maestro, how he had contributed to the crash, and how he had failed to stop it from happening. That line of questioning is an oversimplification of a very complicated story told along with the life of Alan Greenspan in a new biography by Sebastian Mallaby. It's called The Man Who Knew. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
The thing that struck me repeatedly through this book was that for all of his reliance on data and analysis, which you go into it at great length, I mean, the thing is like 700 pages long, Alan Greenspan was an intensely political animal.
That's right. I started out thinking I was going to write a book about a financial statesman. And it became increasingly a story of power and human frailty. It was sort of Machiavellian power meets Shakespearean tragedy because his own personality, his strange upbringing, played into how he managed the financial crisis or the lead up to it at the end of his tenure at the Fed.
A very quick word here about that upbringing. Estranged from his father, a very close relationship with his mother, was a very, I guess you could say he was very interior as a child, right? He lived in his mind.
That's right. So he was spending hours by himself while his mother was out earning a living in the Depression as a sales clerk in a department store. His father left his mother, so he was without that. And I think that introverted, stats-crunching personality that people got to know in America later was very much formed in the crucible of his childhood.
He makes his mark in the sort of economic theory world in 1959, 1960-ish, with a paper about asset prices, about the stock market in particular.
This is one of the most amazing discoveries of my 5 years of research. I would be in his office asking him about his early intellectual development. And after a while, my eyes followed his eyes, and I spied this fat binder sitting up there. And I guessed it must be his missing PhD thesis, which had been lost. And when I said, "Do you have your PhD thesis?" and looked up at the shelf, could see that I was looking at it, so he said yes. And in that thesis, there is something that nobody ever knew that Greenspan wrote. And this is a paper in 1959 where he stresses that central banks' key duty is to fight bubbles, which is ironic, of course, because that's what he didn't do later. And he lays out why. And the reason is that when stock prices go up a lot, not only do consumers spend more, but businesses invest more, and that drives the economic cycle.
He says in 1977, and this it literally stopped me in my tracks. I had to go back and reread it a couple of times. 1977, he says, the assumption of ever-rising prices for new homes is not valid. I mean, holy cow.
Exactly. He predicted the problems in the real estate market in the 70s, and then precisely the same kinds of problems came back in the 2000s, and he was presiding, and you'd have thought he would do something. And what's really amazing is when you read the deliberations between Greenspan and his colleagues at the Fed in the 2000s, he does see that there's a problem. He talks about frothy markets, and he wonders, should the Fed do something about this? That's why I called my book The Man Who Knew, but he was not the man who acted.
After the financial crisis, actually in the middle of the financial crisis, October of 2008, as it's all sort of coming home to us to what it means, Alan Greenspan goes to Capitol Hill. And after having spent 600-ish pages talking about how dapper he was and how his shirts were always pressed and his hair was slicked back, you write, his face was etched with lines and his white shirt collar was rumpled. He's making an appearance before the House Financial Services Committee. And this is the point at which he says, in essence, yeah, maybe I got it wrong.
Greenspan famously said, "I found a flaw. I found a flaw in my worldview, in my ideology." And people seized on this as if that was the moment of confession, showing us that the real reason we had a financial crisis was that we had somebody in charge who was a naive believer in the self-policing efficiency of markets. The truth is that Greenspan never thought markets were efficient. I mean, having spent 5 years reading everything he ever said and wrote, I know. The reason we had a crisis is not that Greenspan didn't understand things about the inefficiency of markets, is that there were political constraints, personal constraints on how far he was willing to go to act against a bubble.
In your conversations with him, what does he say about how he changed the role of chairman of the Fed? Because Ben Bernanke comes in and deals with the crisis. Janet Yellen now is acting in his shadow. Where did he leave it for his successors?
He transformed the status of the Fed. Greenspan was able to fight back against the politicians because he himself was political, and thereby create space for the Fed to be above politics. And by the end of Greenspan's tenure, the Fed's reputation was so exalted in the nation's consciousness that you could have the extraordinary moment after the 2008 crisis when Ben Bernanke went to see the leaders of the House and Senate and said he was going to bail out AIG. Bernanke couldn't have said those things. He couldn't have acted in that way if Greenspan had not been there first to build up the Fed to the point where its prestige made that possible.
Sebastian Mallaby's biography of Alan Greenspan is called The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. Sebastian, thanks very much.
Very nice to be with you.
There's a whole lot more from that interview. Greenspan as politician and as person. It's a really good read. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
It makes no sense to destroy perfectly good firearms that can be used to raise money for these cash-strapped police departments.
The law is the law, but first, let's do the numbers. There you go, the Wawa's, as promised. Dow Industrial's down 200 points today, 1%, 18,128. The NASDAQ down 81 points, 1.5%, 5246. The S&P 500 down 26 points, about 1.2%, closed at 2136. Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf announced a restructuring at that bank and led a conference call with senior executives last night. He told them, quote, things would get harder before they get better, end of quote. Wells down 0.4% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We did a couple of stories last month about manufacturing, about how it used to be, how it's changing, and where it might be going.
Rochester, New York is where we went to tell it because a company that was once ranked the fifth most valuable brand name in the world, one of America's most recognizable companies, is based there. But it's also a company that suffered one of the most remarkable declines, from a peak of about 150,000 employees worldwide to 6,500 today. Kodak, if you haven't guessed yet, is the company in question. After a long slide on the heels of globalization and changing technology, Kodak declared bankruptcy in 2012. Jeff Clark has been the CEO of that company since early 2014. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good day.
A couple of years after Kodak declares bankruptcy, you get a phone call that basically says, Jeff, have we got an opportunity for you? What was that like?
Well, first of all, it's Kodak, one of the most important companies in the history of business. And so you certainly take that call.
You obviously said yes. What was it that you thought you could bring to an iconic American company?
My background has been turning around companies and working in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And so bringing a little bit of Silicon Valley to American icons, a great opportunity.
This is going to sound like a low blow, and I don't mean it to be, but when I went up to Rochester a couple of weeks ago, did my reporting trip came home, and my kid said, hey, Dad, where were you? And I said, I was in Rochester, New York, talking to people at a company called Kodak. And they said, what's Kodak?
That's right. Yeah, it has enormous resonance to those of us who grew up with it. But we've lost a certain generation now, and part of my job is to get them back.
How do you do that, though?
Well, I think it is with what made us great. You know, George Eastman, our founder, brought simplicity to both marketing and product. One of his great statements was, you push the button, we do the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Not many products work that way anymore, and we need to bring that back.
What is Kodak today? It used to be, you know, it was a film and a camera company. And now when you go out and do, you know, whatever CEO pitch you do, what do you tell people?
Well, we're about $2 billion in sales. We're profitable. And one of the things that really we're about is we're about printing. We're about film still. We're about the analog renaissance.
The analog renaissance. Is that like the guy saying, man, you got to try out this vinyl disc and it's going to sound better than a CD?
Absolutely. You know, I think there's some digital fatigue out there, and we believe that science and some real human-based analog matters. It matters in our case with film. It matters with print, where people want to still read books and look at newspapers and see things of incredible quality. Digital has transformed our world, but there's room for both.
Without getting all caught up in the trope of Kodak had the guy who invented the digital camera but couldn't make the digital transition, what, in retrospect and as the guy running the company, what happened to this company?
Well, I think there's been so many case studies written about that, and it's a bit of a time ago. I will put some context around it. First of all, what it showed is that Kodak has the ability to continue to invent things and things that are very important. Many companies have invented great things and not necessarily turned into a Microsoft or a Sony. And so we're very proud that we invented it. By the way, the company did make billions of dollars off of it.
Mm-hmm.
By the intellectual property, so it wasn't a complete waste. That said, clearly, you know, Kodak is focused in a different area now. We're going back to our roots of science and inventing things around material science and chemicals, as well as coming back to consumer products.
Jeff Clark is the CEO of Kodak. Mr. Clark, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Law enforcement in this country spends a whole lot of time trying to get illegal guns off the streets. There are, though, some cities where those guns are being sold back to the public at auction. Macon, Georgia is one of them. The Bibb County Sheriff's Office recently held an auction because it had to. Ellie Yu from WABE brings us this story.
9 Middle Meter High Point. Wait, give her here. 100.
About 100 people are packed into a one-story brick building in Macon at the T. Lynn Davis Auction House. They're eyeing guns up front, where auctioneer Frankie Howell calls on bids in the crowd. Up for sale, a 9 millimeter pistol.
Sold $110, number 19, divide number 19.
That pistol, now belonging to Bidder 19, used to be in the hands of the Bibb County Sheriff's Office. The department here, for the first time, is auctioning off dozens of guns it's held onto. Most are hunting rifles and pistols that were confiscated or used in a crime, like an armed robbery. All of them sell in about an hour.
Hey, now, you doing all right? Good to see you. You buy one of my guns,
Bibb County Sheriff David Davis comes by at the tail end to check in on the auction.
Your dad got one of them?
Yes, sir.
Tell him thanks.
Yes,
sir. Yeah. All right.
In the past, Davis says the sheriff's office used to crush these types of guns into scrap metal. But that changed 4 years ago when lawmakers passed a bill banning the destruction of those guns. Instead, it requires law enforcement agencies now to sell them if they're unclaimed. Davis says he's had some concerns, but his department was just running out of space to store them.
I can understand reticence about selling weapons, that they may wind up on the street, they may wind up doing harm to someone, but we have to do what the law says, and we do get a positive out of it in that there are some funds that will come to the agency and lessen the burden on the taxpayers.
And those buying here, Davis says, are required to have concealed carry permits. Not all departments, though, in the state have followed suit. The Atlanta Police Department hasn't auctioned guns and declined to comment for this story. Georgia is one of about 10 states that have put similar laws on the books in recent years. The measures have been backed by the National Rifle Association. Catherine Mortensen is a spokesperson.
It makes no sense to destroy perfectly good firearms that can be used to raise money for these cash-strapped police departments.
But in Tennessee, where a similar law passed last year, Chattanooga's police chief Fred Fletcher's decided against selling the guns.
Because I don't believe that the small amount of money raised is worth the risk to the brave men and women who put themselves between those firearms and our community on a daily basis.
He says last year his officers confiscated more than 700 guns, and selling them would go against what his officers have been doing.
We have made it a deliberate effort to target anybody who would carry guns illegally and put them in jail and take those guns off the street where they will not hurt our community members.
Back in Macon, resident Willie McCrary stands in line to register for the auction. He came for the guns.
It's a good thing as long as you have the proper documents and your license and stuff that you need to get it legally. I think it's a good thing.
In the end, the sheriff's office says it raised more than $18,000 from the auction. Sheriff Davis says he can use the money to buy equipment and fund officer training.
With the way the economy is and the way things are, we want to find the most bang for our buck, pardon the pun.
His office is now getting ready to auction off hundreds of more firearms it has in store. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Ellie Yu for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. So you know the whole weird, scary clown thing that's going on? Well, get this. BuzzFeed is reporting today that McDonald's has cut back on public appearances of Ronald McDonald because of all those weird, scary clowns. Here's the quote from the company. McDonald's and franchisees in the local markets are mindful of the current climate around clown sightings in communities and as such are being thoughtful in respect to Ronald McDonald's participation in community events for the time being, end of quote. And yes, I agree. Ronald McDonald is a little weird and scary, too, but still kind of sad. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 200 points today, 1%. The Nasdaq down 81 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 26 points. That is 1.2%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody, back in Los Angeles. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.